So there is a title to this talk, and it's the same title as the retreat, as the weekend. It's Inviting the Enlightened Mind. As I said last night, that way of looking at spiritual practice as being about how we invite the enlightened mind into our experience to get a glimpse of it or a taste of it, that's perhaps not the way we're used to thinking about it. We may be more used to thinking in terms of creating our own enlightenment inside ourselves or uncovering our own enlightened mind, something like that. But the enlightened mind is something that's outside our present experience. It's outside of us as we are now. It's not something we can manufacture by cobbling together bits of ourselves, bits of our existing selves, in a different way. It's not a slightly improved version of the person we are now. It's not something we, as we are now, can make or force into existence. When we get glimpses of it, or when we feel the faintest touch of it, the experience is that it's something coming from outside, something wonderful coming from outside. Okay, of course, it's a really important practice, part of our practice, for us to do work. A lot of our practice does involve working on our mind, on our heart, to develop positive qualities, mindfulness, metta, and we do that. But, as I said, enlightenment isn't just a better version of ourselves, our old mundane selves. Enlightenment is something other. It's something beyond anything our present mind can conceive. It's even better than anything we can imagine. So, thinking of the enlightened mind as something that we can only invite in so that it will honour us with a glimpse of itself, as something wonderful coming from outside, that's actually a really useful way of thinking about practice because it matches our actual experience. And it's a way of thinking about practice that actually has a really long pedigree. It's really quite mainstream, as I'll say more about that later. So we invite the enlightened mind into our experience in the same way that we might invite an honoured guest into our living space. And if we want to invite an honoured guest into our living space, we don't demand that they come. We can't make them come. What we need to do is to create the conditions that make them want to come. If we're inviting an honoured guest, think of the person you'd feel most sort of awed to invite into your house or your living space around for a cup of tea or a meal. Think of that and then think of what you would do. Well, one thing that they are not going to come if our house is dirty and messy. If our partner doesn't really want them there. If there's going to be squabbling. If the kids are going to be having tantrums and throwing food around, they're not going to want to come. If we want them to come, we need to create a comely, harmonious environment where they'll be welcomed and treated appropriately, and they need to know that. We invite an honoured guest by creating the sort of environment that means they want to come and spend time with us. And inviting the enlightened mind obviously is no different. We invite it by creating suitable conditions, a suitable environment, a beautiful, harmonious environment that's in keeping with the beauty and the harmony of what we're inviting. And we need to let our honoured guests know that they are honoured. That we feel respect and even reverence for them. If it's like, oh, you know, you could drop in, you know, whoever it is, you know, Nelson Mandela, were he alive, oh, you know, why don't you just drop in for a cup of tea sometime, mate, sort of thing. We've got to show our respect. And of course, the environment we're inviting the enlightened mind into is our mind. It's our heart, our mind, our emotions and our attitudes and our thoughts. And our mind can be just like the sort of environment I mentioned earlier. Dirty and messy, full of squabbling, with sort of archetypal kids throwing food around or something. And the enlightened mind will not go near that, will not go near that sort of place. So we need to cultivate the appropriate moods and emotions and attitudes that make our mind a suitable place. And I think we could see all the aspects of our practice as being about that. I mean, we could see that sort of wonderful state of mind that we can sometimes get into through the mindfulness of breathing, that clear, expansive, poised state. We could see that as a way of inviting at least a glimpse of the enlightened mind, or the warm heart that we cultivate in the metta bhavana. We could see that as creating the sort of environment the enlightened mind might wish to come into, or at least touch. We could see living an upright, honest life, upright, ethical life as a way of inviting the enlightened mind, creating a comely situation, friendship, all of those things. So we could see all the aspects, I think, of our practice in those, in that way. But there's one practice that very explicitly takes this approach, where this metaphor of inviting the enlightened mind is completely central, and that's the Sevenfold Puja. A lot of you will know this, but the Sevenfold Puja is a series of guided reflections, guided meditations, along with some ritual actions, designed to take us through a progressive series of seven spiritual attitudes, spiritual moods, which constitute a fuller and fuller invitation to the enlightened mind, starting with, you know, come around for tea, and ending up with, well, why don't you move in? It starts with us inviting the enlightened mind around for tea, and ends up with us giving our house to them, surrendering to them, if you like, surrendering to the enlightened mind. We become a home of the enlightened mind. It hasn't just dropped in for tea. At least in our imagination, we rehearse that, what it might look like, what it might feel like. But that all starts by inviting it in. And this, as I said, is a really mainstream way of looking at what we do in our practice. The words of the Sevenfold Puja are taken from an 8th century poem by an Indian monk called Shantideva. The puja is in the second and third chapter of that text, the Bodhicharyavatara, the guide to the path of enlightenment. And the Bodhicharyavatara, in which we've taken those words for the puja, this is one of the most important and influential texts in Mahayana Buddhism, what we might call Northern Buddhism. It's almost certainly, I think, the most influential text in Tibetan Buddhism. The Dalai Lama says he reads it every day. It's his main inspiration. It was the first text, I believe, that Sangharakshita led study on after founding the order. It's a really, really important text. And in that text, this is very explicit, this practice of inviting the enlightened mind. So this way of seeing what we're doing when we do Dharma practice is mainstream. It's important. It's not something we just came up with as a snappy title for this retreat. Okay. So when Shantideva, this 8th century Indian monk who wrote the Bodhicharyavatara, when he talks about what I've been calling the enlightened mind, the term he uses, the traditional term bodhicitta, which Padmavajra used last night. Bodhi, enlightenment, awakening, chitta, heart, mind. So the enlightened mind, the awakened heart, the bodhicitta. Bodhicitta's got a sort of whole wealth of meaning, really, that to people who've sort of been around for the Dharma for a while, so it's much better to leave it untranslated, I think. So the bodhicitta. It's the enlightened mind, but it's the enlightened mind conceived as an active force in the universe. It's not the mind of any individual. It's something transpersonal. We heard last night about the Buddha being a rain cloud that spreads the Dharma to everyone. Well, maybe we're talking about something like the bodhicitta when we talk about that. So, yeah, the bodhicitta was seen as something that exists both in us and in the universe. Shantideva talks about it as if it was the basis of all good qualities that might develop, all skillful actions that we might do. Seen as a sort of cosmic will in the direction of enlightenment, a cosmic movement in the direction of enlightenment, which individuals could align themselves with and allow to act through them. A stream of volition, acting through the whole universe, that we could invite into ourselves, allow to act through us, if we could get our sort of little ego wants out of the way. So that seems to be the way that Shantideva saw it. And when he addresses himself to the enlightened mind, he's addressing himself to this bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, that might be a bit sort of vague. I mean, we need something we can imagine, don't we? We need an image or something we can imagine. We need something a bit more concrete than what's perhaps a vague term to us. So Shantideva addresses himself to the Buddha. He addresses himself to the Buddha, to the Buddhas, to figures such as Avalokiteshvara, Manjugosha, Vajrapani, and also to great human beings, great people worthy of respect. So he sees these as a sort of concrete manifestations of the bodhicitta. As though the bodhicitta was a great light, and these great beings are windows through which that light shines. They're different individuals, they're still individuals, but they're lit up by the fact that the bodhicitta is shining through them, acting through them, and therefore they're deserving of respect and admiration and devotion as sort of expressions of the bodhicitta. So that's how Shantideva talks in his puja. That's how he sees the bodhicitta in relation to himself, and we could try thinking about that, thinking like that. So as we do a puja, thinking of ourselves in relationship to an enlightened mind, to the bodhicitta, which is transpersonal, but which shines through beings such as the Buddha and others, and other admirable people. In fact, shines through all skillful acts anywhere. And maybe also shines out of the beauty of the world, which I'll say a bit more about that later. So, in the rest of this talk, I'm going to do two things. Firstly, I'm going to go through the stages of the Sevenfold Puja, because I'm sure some of you will not have had these explained in the way they do sort of link together and progress. If that seems like, if you're thinking, oh, well, I can go to sleep now, because I've heard all of that before, I'm sorry, but bear with me. It might sort of refresh your memory, it might refresh your experience of the puja. And I'll try to suggest as I go along some ways of using the imagination to sort of bring the puja alive. So the puja is a meditation, it's a sort of meditation, and we need to conjure up the images that it evokes. We need to sort of really enter into the moods that it's talking about, not just say the words by rote, which is all too easy to sort of get into. So I'll suggest some ways we can sort of enliven it for ourselves. So yeah, as I said, two parts. The first part, I'm going to go through the stages. Bear with me. And in the second part, I'm going to talk about the attitude, the underlying attitude that the puja expresses and cultivates. What is that attitude? What is the fundamental attitude behind the puja? Why is it absolutely necessary for our spiritual life, and how do we develop it outside the puja as well as inside the puja? How do we make it much more just a part of our overall life practice? Okay, so first of all, I'll go through the stages of the puja. So in the first stage we call worship. And here we're already, well, we start out with mandarava flowers raining down. I'm told that mandarava flowers are huge golden flowers, as large as cartwheels, which frequently fall down from the sky when the Buddha teaches. It's always sounded very dangerous to me. But we're already in an archetypal, imaginal realm. And then we start immediately with this metaphor, this poetic image of inviting the honoured guest into our experience, into our living space. We imagine garlanding them with flowers, as people still do as an expression of respect in India. We imagine ourselves making the 7 traditional Indian offerings that were made to an honoured guest that we invited into our house. So food, hard and soft. I always imagine dal and rice, like last night. Water for drinking, water for washing, perfume, flowers and light. We illuminate our living space, make it beautiful and inviting. And these, as you probably know, but these seven traditional offerings are symbolized by the seven offering bowls we always have on a shrine. So really every time we go into a shrine room, when we're facing a shrine, we've got this imagery of inviting the honored guest. We're inviting the honored guest with the seven traditional offerings on the shrine. So having in our imagination invited, garlanded, offered to, been as hospitable as we possibly can to the honoured guest, inviting them into our living space, we normally chant a mantra. We chant a mantra, invoking some aspect of the enlightened mind. And I think this is an extension of the invitation. When we chant a mantra, we're inviting some aspect of the enlightened mind to touch our experience, to touch our awareness. And as we chant that mantra, we physically make offerings. We bow and we physically make offerings to the shrine. So we don't just engage our mind and our speech, we engage our bodies. And I think that's particularly challenging, particularly effective. Bowing physically has a lot more clout than just saying some words of respect. And I remember, Pama Vajra didn't say about this, but when I first came across the puja, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And bow. There's no way I was going to bow. There's absolutely no way I was going to bow to a shrine. It took me ages to bow. Far too much pride, far too much ego, far too concerned with what I looked like. So bowing is, people talk about going beyond the ego. Bowing is going beyond the ego. Bowing is physically showing that we regard something as higher than ourselves. So bowing, a really powerful practice of going beyond the proud, exalted ego. And then we move on to the second stage, salutation. So a salutation is a respectful greeting. But in the context of Eastern culture, that means bowing. It doesn't mean how do you do, it means bowing, or even prostrating. So having invited the enlightened mind, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas into our experience in the worship section, bowed to them physically, we also conjure up this image of ourselves bowing. By bowing, we acknowledge that the bodhicitta is bigger than we are, that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas stand above us. If we're inviting an honoured guest, we need to show our respect, acknowledge that there are things about them we can only aspire to. So we show this, we bow. In fact, we imagine ourselves bowing as many atoms as there are, as many atoms as there are. And it sort of gives this impression that's sequential, you know, I'm going to do it over and over again, which would actually take a very long time to bow as many times as there are atoms in the universe. I think it's more traditional to think of this in terms of there's, as it were, a copy of us in every atom of the universe bowing all at once, so that we imagine an image of ourselves in every atom of the universe bowing, so we are bowing and the universe is bowing along with us to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And in this stage, we move from, as it were, the highest, most abstract level, all the Buddhas of the 3 eras, we gradually get more and more and more concrete until we get down to earth, until we get to actual people we could meet in our lives, teachers and those to whom respectful salutation is due. We all know people to whom respectful salutation is due, or we know of them. We know people who are further along the path than we are, and we can imagine ourselves bowing to them. Once again, this starts to get a bit more challenging. It's easier to bow to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but to think of actually bowing to people we respect might get a bit more challenging. So we can imagine ourselves doing that, really connecting with our respect for people we know and including them in that stage. Then we get on to the third stage, going for refuge. So going for refuge, bit of Buddhist jargon that most closely translates as commitment. It's not enough to just invite the enlightened mind into our experience, show our respect for it. We also need to align our lives with it, ourselves with it. So the way we are living is in accord with it, not in conflict. So the respect we showed needs to express itself in becoming more like that ourselves, really committing ourselves to the path, to making it a reality. So we commit to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we chant the refuges, and we commit to the precepts, the most basic principles of living a Buddhist life: kindness, generosity, simplicity, straightforwardness, awareness. Then the next stage after that is confession of faults. Having committed ourselves to the precepts, we may well become painfully aware of all the ways we don't practice them. All the habits that keep us stuck in our own small perspective. The fact that the space that we're inviting the enlightened mind into is still a bit dirty, that the cups need washing and the bin's a bit smelly. So the next stage of the we need to understand, see the obstacles that are in our way, or our practice is completely delusional. So the next stage of the puja is confession. We acknowledge the unskillful tendencies that block us from higher states. We express regret for the unskillful actions that we're habitually prone to, and we decide to behave differently in the future. So then the next stage is a sort of contrast. From regretting, acknowledging unskillful tendencies, blocks, etc., we move to rejoicing. Rejoicing in skillful actions, including our own. Rejoicing in merits, the stage of rejoicing in merits. We think of all the manifestations of what is skillful that we see around us, from the small everyday acts of ordinary people, right up to the manifestations of the Dharma and the Sangha in our lives, to the existence of the great spiritual heroes, the great beings, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And we rejoice. We celebrate that. We express our delight and our gratitude. So what's this about? What's this about? Apart from sort of cheering us up a bit after the confession section, what's this about? Well, I think it's about an increasing levels of, as it were, identification with the bodhicitta, support for the bodhicitta, support for this tendency in the universe. And my analogy for this is supporting a sports team, okay? Supporting a sports team. So we start out as we don't know the sports team, and then we decide, I shall become a fan of Liverpool. Hooray! And then when we become a fan of Liverpool, we sort of start to identify with Liverpool. And the way that comes across is that we really rejoice every time Liverpool wins a game. We rejoice when they score. We rejoice when they do something good. So we're starting to identify with Liverpool. Although we haven't scored the goal, you know, we're identified. We rejoice. And then maybe we go a bit beyond that. Maybe rather than just being a fan of the bodhicitta, we want to actually play in its team. So we play in the bodhicitta's team. We move from being a fan to playing in the team. And then we rejoice every time somebody scores a goal. We don't only rejoice, you know, well, I didn't score it, doesn't matter. We rejoice every time somebody does something good or somebody scores a goal. We don't have to be the star striker. But we still have this identification which, as it were, connects us to the star strikers, if you like. So we're increasing levels of identification with an involvement in the bodhicitta project, the project of the evolution of consciousness on this planet, where we rejoice in all its successes, not just our own. And I think this does represent a really quite important practice, actually, for us. Just this rejoicing in merits, I think it's really worth time spending time meditating on, bringing it into our metta bhavana, where we just rejoice in people. We just think of the things that, you know, list them, praise people in our minds, rejoice in things. So then we get to entreaty and supplication, the next stage. In this stage, we're asking for a teaching and showing receptivity that we're open to higher influence. We want to be taught that we want the bodhicitta, the Buddhas and bodhisattvas, to influence us. We're open to their advice. All too often, I'm afraid, all too often, no matter what we think, all too often, at some sort of quite deep level, we think we already know it all. We think the image of the model of the universe we've got in our heads is the right one. We've got our views and opinions, and we're not open to anything that contradicts them. But if we're not open to something higher than we are at the moment, we are stuck. Why don't we go home and start our own religion? If we're right about everything, we're stuck if that's what we think. We need to develop this mental state of receptivity, of openness, of welcoming new teachings, even teachings that challenge our old positions based on our sort of ego's view of itself. So that's the next to last spiritual mood. We express this openness and receptivity, asking to be taught, not just digging in and defending our present views. And after that, we usually listen to a teaching. We listen to a teaching from the Buddhist canon and chant the Heart Sutra. Let me get to the last stage, which is the culmination of the puja, dedication of merits and self-surrender, the climax, what we've been building towards. We started with inviting the bodhicitta into our living space. Now we are inviting it to move in, if you like, or at least we're rehearsing that imagination. In our imagination, we rehearse giving ourselves, opening up to the bodhicitta, to the big mind that connects us to all beings, opening up to the enlightened mind. And I say we rehearse it because we're probably not ready to do it yet. We probably cannot say those words completely. I give up my personalities throughout my existences. I give up my possessions. Great, I'll have your car. Do we really mean those words? We say those words, but can we really mean them? Do we really want to be serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings? This is an incredibly high aspiration. We almost certainly can't mean it totally, but I don't think we should let that worry us. We shouldn't let that worry us, because what we're doing is a rehearsal. We're preparing for enlightenment the way children prepare for adulthood. If you watch children, what do? They pretend. They play at being brave. They play at being all sorts of things, as a sort of rehearsal for bringing those things into their existence, into their personality. And in a sense, that's what we're doing. We're playing at being bodhisattvas. We're playing. We're rehearsing that in our mind. And this part of us does deeply want that. And this rehearsing sort of strengthens that. It brings it out into the open. So at least in our imagination, we offer ourselves to the bodhicitta. Okay, and again, I say that's a very high goal. And doing a puja is, I think Sangharakshita Bhante has said it's quite an advanced practice. I think at one point he said perhaps only order members should do it. It's an advanced practice. It's a bodhicitta practice. But it can work at lots of levels. It can also work at a more down-to-earth level as a way of expressing our shared values and our aspirations, strengthening our commitment to these strengthen our commitment to each other. So I think it's fine to relate to the puja at that sort of level. As an enjoyable bit of theatre and poetry and chanting, which connects our mind with the idea of enlightenment and expresses and strengthens our common sense of community, our common aspirations and shared values. Okay, so just the last bit of my sort of consideration of the puja itself. The puja is something we do in relationship. We do it in relationship to something outside ourselves. And I've talked about the bodhicitta, but we probably need something a bit more concrete than the bodhicitta, perhaps. We need something that we can actually get an image of in our imagination, something like that. We usually do the puja as we face a shrine. We're facing a shrine, and usually shrines have got a Buddha image on them. So the Buddha is the most obvious symbol of the enlightened mind, of the positive qualities of what we could become. So we might relate to the Buddha as the historical Shakyamuni, the historical person of flesh and blood. But the Buddha image can also represent, if you like, Buddhahood itself, the enlightened mind that transcends time and space, and is active in the universe. We heard last night about the rain cloud, the Buddha teaching the Dharma to all beings. This is the Buddha as a cosmic principle. This is not the Buddha as an individual. So we could think of it in that way. So we do a puja. We could experiment our imagination with putting ourselves in relationship to the Buddha, using the Buddha to sum up the positive qualities we love and admire. Imagine ourselves making offerings to the Buddha as a symbol of the enlightened mind, as the source of the stream of positive energy, which is the Buddhist tradition, and has come down to us here and now, the elder brother of mankind, etc. The leader that we follow. And of course we can extend that idea to other figures from the Buddhist tradition, Avalokiteshvara, the mantra we chant, Manjugosha, etc. I think if we feel a particular connection with a figure, then doing the puja in relationship to that figure, bowing to that figure. But I have to say, sometimes for me, none of these really do it. None of these really do it. What I feel myself in relationship to when I do a puja, what I admire and revere, the best way I can symbolize this, I mean, is to describe it as a sort of bright blur, really. A sort of bright blur, the source of goodness and beauty in the world. The whole Buddhist tradition, the Sangha down the ages, the stream of positive volition that I feel is still acting in the world and which I can be a part of. I can only represent this to myself as a sort of bright blur, a palpable feeling in my body, compounded of gratitude and admiration and a sense of commitment, a sense of direction, a sense of what my life has to be about. And it's all quite intangible. It's quite too deep to be a particular image or a set of words, really. And actually, I don't mind it being a bright blur, because what I'm referring to, I think, is indefinable. I think we get into trouble if we define it too much. Can't be pinned down. No words can do justice to it. No image can capture it. Okay, so I've talked a little bit about the puja. For the rest of this talk, I'd like to say a bit more about the sort of fundamental attitude or emotion or spiritual mood that runs through the puja and why that is essential for our practice and how we might develop it. So the underlying mood of the whole puja is respect, moving into reverence. So we invite the enlightened mind into our experience and we make offerings to the way it manifests in the world. We show respect as to an honoured guest. And when the honoured guest is something as sublime as the enlightened mind, these feelings of admiration and respect shade over into feelings of reverence and even awe. So the word reverence, I think it sums up a whole complex of emotions around our response to what's really admirable, higher and larger and more important than our egos. It's got strands of admiration, love, gratitude, and even awe. I think reverence is the emotion we feel towards something or someone who dwarfs us. Something or someone who dwarfs our ego. Something beautiful. Something a bit awesome. And as such, reverence is a really crucial part of inviting the enlightened mind. It's a crucial part of our whole spiritual lives, a crucial part of our practice. Unless we recognize that something is higher than ourselves, we are stuck. Why change? Why change if we are the best there is? We are the most important thing there is. Why change? We'll just serve our own wants. Why not? They're the most important thing. So to grow spiritually, we really absolutely need this sense that there's something greater than ourselves. We need to admire and love that something or that somebody. We need to cultivate an attitude of reverence to something or somebody. And that might be a bit of a challenging idea. I have to say that's a bit of a challenging idea. Emotions like reverence are denigrated in our culture. They're really looked down upon in our culture. We've been strongly conditioned, I think, by our society to think that there is something wrong with feeling reverence and even admiration. Our society conditions us to think that we sort of demean ourselves, lose our dignity if we revere something outside of ourselves. I think the prevailing myth in our society is the myth of Genesis, that we are created in the image of God, and God has given us the right to have dominion over the world, to use the world to get what we want, basically. The world exists to serve our wants. So we have that myth, and then what we've done now is strip God out of that. We've stripped God out of that, which was the only thing that kept us humble. So that now what we're left with is the myth of the mammoth me made in the image of God. Everything becomes about me, me, me. Me and my wants, which leads to the whole consumer society thing and chewing up the world, basically. We become like big babies crying to be fed. Babies quite rightly focus on getting their own needs met. But adults should be about something a bit more important than that. So to stop being such big babies, we need to open our eyes and recognise that we aren't the most important things in the world, and our wants are not the most important thing in the world. Unless we grow up and start recognising that there are things much more beautiful and important and admirable than our own desires, we can't get anywhere. Even our spiritual practice becomes just more about me, 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 without reverence. We need to break out of that to get anywhere. So revering something bigger than our own wants doesn't demean us, as society tells us. It means we're starting to grow up. It means we're starting to grow up. There's nothing at all dignified about being a big me, me, me baby. There is something very dignified and very noble about basing our lives on something bigger than our own wants. So to make progress, we need to open up to the emotions that a healthy being experiences when they come against something higher and more important than themselves. So we say that metta becomes compassion when it hits suffering. It becomes joy when it hits when it hits other people's happiness. And in the same way, I think reverence is what happens when metta, love, meets something or someone that we recognise is higher and deeper and larger and more admirable than our own small selves and our own little concerns, more important than our own concerns. So I think reverence is what an emotionally healthy being feels when they experience the wonder and beauty and majesty of the universe as well. When we're moved by art, when we connect with noble values and principles, when we come across people who express those values and principles in their lives. And without that sense of living in relationship to something higher than our own wants, we can't really live a meaningful life. And that means we can't live a happy life. If we're not about something bigger than our own little wants, our life will feel empty. And if our life feels empty, we will be unhappy. And this is really strongly brought out in the Pali Canon, actually, in an episode in the life of the Buddha. So shortly after his enlightenment, in the Gaurava Sutta, it describes how the Buddha was reflecting on the fact that there was no human being he could look up to anymore. He says there's nobody in this generation he could look up to and admire and revere and obey. And we're told that he thought, well, different translations have it differently. A man is unhappy if he has nobody to love and revere and obey. Actually, the Pali says simply a man without reverence is unhappy, or a man without reverence lives unhappily. But he thought, there's nobody I can be a disciple of in this generation. But a man is unhappy if he has nobody to revere. And we're told that he thought, I will love and revere and obey the Dharma. I will serve the Dharma. And what the Buddha meant by Dharma wasn't just his own teaching. I mean, the Buddha could hardly look up to and revere a teaching that he invented himself, as it were. Dharma in Buddhism has a double meaning, or has maybe perhaps more than double meaning, but one meaning is the teaching of the Buddha, the teaching of Buddhism. Another meaning is the way things are, the nature of the way things are. The awe-inspiring nature of the universe we're part of, with its great beauty and its scary mystery and its mind-boggling hugeness. So the Buddha thought, to live a happy life, I need to serve something bigger than myself. I need to revere something bigger than myself. I will serve the very nature of the way things are, the Dharma. Now, most of us, I think, have been conditioned to think of the universe as a sort of dead machine. But clearly the Buddha didn't see it that way. With his enlightened vision, with his Buddha eye, he saw there's something in the very nature of things that is worthy of reverence. The universe is not just a dead machine. There is something beautiful and awesome woven into the very nature of reality. The nature of things is such that consciousness exists. The nature of things is such that it evolves towards higher and higher levels. So if we, the nature of things rewards ethical actions. So if we live according to the nature of things, live ethically according to the Dharma, then there's a current in the nature of things that will carry us towards greater and greater awareness, greater and greater connection, towards enlightenment. When we first felt the first urge to meditate and practice the Dharma, it was the nature of things speaking through us that made us want that. That pushed us in that direction. When we feel that ethical actions are more beautiful than unethical actions, this is the nature of things. It's built into us. And for those of us who know what these terms mean, what I am talking about, I think, is what could be called, and is often called in our movement, by the incredibly ugly and unevocative terms karma niyama processes and dharma niyama processes. What these terms mean is, I think, is summed up by what I've already said. I haven't really got the time to go into them now, but if we live according to the nature of things, according to the Dharma, there is a current in the nature of things that will carry us towards greater awareness and connection towards enlightenment. And eventually that current will become so strong that it's unstoppable. So I think that might be the first aspect, that might be an aspect of the nature of things that the Buddha revered, that it's built into the structure of the universe, consciousness and the fact that ethical actions are rewarded and that there's a movement towards enlightenment. I can think of lots of things that we might revere in the nature of things. The awe-inspiring nature of the universe. We're part of, with its huge, its great beauty and its scary mystery and its mind-boggling hugeness. So as I've said, we Westerners are often not very good at reverence, but we need to cultivate it. We need to cultivate reverence if we're going to get far. And maybe this sort of respect, this awe in nature can give us a way in. Because although we find it difficult to feel reverence for other people, or even perhaps for symbols, we can perhaps start by feeling reverence for the beauty of nature. That's certainly how it happened with me, I must admit. I mean, I described my early experience in puja. There. Hate it. Hate it. And look at them there. Throwing themselves on the floor. This was my first experience. My first experience of the Dharma was coming on a retreat at Padmaloka, and there were people prostrating, and I'm going, oh my God, what's going on? Perhaps they're having heart attacks. But I mean, basically, I wasn't going to do that. And it took me ages and ages to get together the courage to bow to a shrine. And my first experience of actually bowing was going for a walk in a Peak District near where I live and being overawed by a landscape and a sunset. And I just felt a really strong urge to bow to it. So I think that can be a way in to at least a start of a sense of, yeah, there's something around. There's something around that I can bow to. So you might try doing that. We've actually had retreats in Sheffield in the Peak District where we've encouraged people to bow to things that cause them to feel awe. And it was really interesting because one morning I remember it was a lovely day and we used this place. There's a beautiful view with a lake down below and people were sort of standing there like this, looking at the view, and I had suggested that people might try bowing at things, and there was a sort of people would go. Of course, it's much more difficult to bow to people. How about allowing ourselves to revere actual people? Don't look for the feet of clay. A man is unhappy if he has nothing to revere. We can find feet of clay anywhere. We can make ourselves unhappy if we want. If we're looking for someone perfect, we will look for a long time. If we're looking for somebody who has got qualities we don't have, we will find them very, very quickly. And a man is unhappy if he has nothing to revere. So why not make ourselves happy by choosing to think of people we revere and actually cultivating that, actually allowing it to happen? A man without reverence is unhappy. So think of people, even people we know, even people perhaps around our centre or people we know of. Rejoice in their merits in the Metta Bhavana. Rejoice in their merits in the Metta Bhavana. Think, yeah, that person's like that. That's really great. Rejoice in their merits in the Metta Bhavana. And perhaps imagine bowing, including them in our bowing in the puja. I bow to all those worthy of respect. And even, if you dare, express your respect when next you see them. Say, I really respect you for that. Anyway. How about revering also, allowing ourselves, learning to revere all those who have benefited us, those who have really benefited us, even if we don't know them. Someone who wrote that book that really influenced us. How about revering Sangharakshita, without whom we wouldn't be here? Instead of looking for the feet of clay, if there are any, you know, how about just thinking, what have we been given? What have we been given? And how great is that? And yes, I'm willing to bow to that. I'm willing to bow to the qualities that brought that about. So I think, rejoice in merits, feel gratitude, and allow them to turn into respect and admiration. A man is unhappy without reverence. So why not be happy? Thank you.